salta mi jale, jaleya, uy, cuy, jule, jaleya, uy, cuy, jule.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project. This program is California Contemporary Indian Artists.
When I was 11 years old, I knew I was going to be an artist. I didn't know what kind. I grew up in an environment where there was no art in the house to speak of, and I don't know what happened, where this came from.
I don't think that growing up I thought I was going to become a basket weaver. I was curious about them, and I was very drawn to the baskets. I knew that somehow I was connected.
I wanted to be like Edward Curtis. He went out here in this document in the American Indian, and then also part of his thing was it's going to be the vanishing breed. But I think mine's to the opposite of that. I just wanted to show that California Indians are alive and well.
Contemporary California Native artists have created their own niche in the art world. This program profiles five California Native visual artists who, like their work, reflect the paths they have taken to maintain their own cultural preservation and identity. Their work sets them apart from the stereotypical images usually associated with Indian art. I'm Kathy Chapman. We'll hear from performance artist James Luna, photographer Dugan Aguilar, basket weaver Susie Billy, and painters Jean Lamar and Harry Fonseca.
I'm Harry Fonseca. I'm living here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, originally from California, and I am Maidu Indian from North Central California. There were, I remember, six pieces of cardboard in the corner, and I picked them up, and I just started to play around, and my first painting I did was a coyote in a leather jacket and Levi's and high-top tennis shoes, and I did three of those, I remember, and then I did three female figures as well with flower dresses on and platform high heels. That began it. I was just so delighted, you know, with the color, all the color, and also being able to use a mythological figure that had a tremendous amount of depth to him and could be used in a lot of different situations. And so after that evening, it just started. It was like a rock being shot from a slingshot. I was just really going to town and began using coyote in a lot of different ways, and Rose and the Rez Sisters was one. You know, growing up and listening to the Marvelettes and Martha and the Vandellas and, you know, all the music from Motown and so forth. And I thought, oh, okay, we'll put Rose up here and see what we can do. And so that's where Rose and the Red Sisters came about. And it was great fun for a lot of young Native American women to see this powerful image, you know, singing. At that time, I was participating in a ceremony in Northern California, and so there was like these two worlds that were coming together, almost colliding. Actually, they were colliding when I really sat down and thought about it. And so finding this, or being introduced, I guess would be a better way to put it, this coyote figure allowed me to put that figure in a world that's really happening for me today. And so that's why you just see him in so many different disguises. And I never, ever forgot when I was painting the figure, while I put trappings on him, that he was still a mythological character, that he was a trickster, that he was a survivor, that he was a destroyer, that he was a creator. And I think that that's what gave the pieces their power, because they weren't just cute dogs, you know. Coyote had a bite to him. This piece here that you were looking at is the Maidu creation story, and that's all based on the petroglyphs, you know, from Northern California, and also some takeoffs from images in New Mexico as well. It starts off with Helen Maide, who is the creator, and he's on a raft with turtle. So you've got this figure, and you've got a little round circle representing turtle. And to the right of him is Coriyampe, because turtle was tired of floating around and asked Helen Maide if they could find a place to rest. So Helen Maide called Coriyampe down, who is the earth maker, and Coriyampe descended on a feathered rope in the form of a sun. And he lands on the raft with Coriyampe, and Helen Maide takes turtle and puts turtle in the water, and turtle goes down, and he's gone for 4 days, some myths say 4 years. When turtle gets back, Coriyampe takes the dirt from under the turtle's claws and places a little ball of it on the water, and it grows to be the world. And what goes on around them now is the creation of the plants, the animals, the first people, the dance cycle, how we respect our elders, how we respect people that die, or how we respect death, actually. And then there's a rain of fire that destroys the world, and except for a few people, of course, and the cycle begins over and over again.
My name is James Luna. I'm a Luseño Indian and live on the La Jolla Indian Reservation here in North County, San Diego. Well, I'm a visual artist. I'm an installation and performance artist, and I don't really separate the two. I mean, to me, they come from the same discipline, visual arts. And the same decisions that I make for installation, I make for performance. There was a point in my life where I just sort of stopped and said, well, who am I? It wasn't like I was born in a cave or born in a teepee and that I am isolated from everything. I mean, you know, I grew up in Orange County, California. So I stopped being in denial that American culture was part of my culture as well, and so started adding elements of that. And so I became whole. The work became whole. I use a lot of pop music in my work. I use a lot of pop music in my work, both in installation and performance. And then people wonder, well, gee, you know, how come that works? Mother, mother, there's too many of you. In an installation where it's about the ritual of dance, in there in the darkness, in the video, fire on the floor and the smell of willow leaves and these sculptural dancers made out of crutches. You hear the sound of nature, that you hear the sound of What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. It works. You know, why? Well, because to me that's almost a tribal song. And then it alludes to nature, and then it alludes to maybe some kind of wordy that you would find in a tribal song. Sometimes I make entrances to Barry White or Frank Sinatra in a performance, you know, and I'm dressed up in this sort of half Indian, half Las Vegas garb, and you know, why does it work? Because it just does. If I perform for a Native group, which I don't have that much of an opportunity to do like I'd like, you know, there's immediate response to the inside jokes, the imagery and things, because I script them for Indian people. If I do maybe the same performance for a non-Indian group, you know, there's a little hesitation to laugh. They have to have the okay from something or somebody to laugh at some of the things that are both poignant and sad. The inside jokes they don't get, but that leaves them kind of wondering. But that's part of the sexiness of my work. And my work, in a lot of respects, encourages people to go out and find out about these things that they don't understand. Because it's a barrage not only about inner things about my culture, but it also speaks about how I feel, you know, how Native people may feel about certain things. And a lot of times, many times, we're not asked for really our opinion. People have a lot of opinions about us, but they don't particularly ask us about ours. And a lot of times what they ask, they don't really ask us how we feel. They ask us how we see things. And that's a lot of difference. Well, the Shaman is a character that I wrote up and traveled to about 14 different places in 4 years. It was a performance dealing with the wholesale sale of Indian spiritual ways and objects, because I'd see this stuff for sale and see these quote-unquote medicine men or shaman selling these vision quests and sweat lodge ceremonies and medicine wheel gatherings to people in need. And I got revolted by it. And so I created this character, this one-man performance that deals with all these different issues in kind of a humorous but biting way. And the theme for the shaman, because I didn't even like that word shaman, that in this performance, during this performance, and at the conclusion of the performance, you know, he builds to this end where he asks people, and just for a few dollars donation, he'll take their ethnic shame from them. You know, shame of being ethnic, or shame of thinking things about ethnic people. He'll take it on his shoulders and he'll mount his pony, his sawhorse with a blanket on it. And at the conclusion of the performance, when he dismounts his pony, all the shame will be gone and we can start 500 and some odd years all over again. I tell people, you don't have to look around for your culture. You don't have to wear knickers and start doing these jigs to be Irish or German. You don't have to wear a toga to be Italian or Roman. You don't have to put feathers on to be Indian. That might be part of your heritage, but it's really not your culture. Your culture is here right now. It's rock and roll, it's spaceships, it's computers, it's the Civil War, it's civil rights. The only thing wrong with, and it's nothing wrong, it's just something that Americans comprehend, is that this is a new culture. And they don't have to go looking anyplace else. It's right here. It's in them. That's them. And I'd like to think when I use pop imagery in my work, that's what I'm saying. I'm not into denial of that this is not a part of me.
Well, purple to me is a very important color. I was named Bahit Magutni, which means a purple flower girl. I just used that in my work a lot. It goes with everything anyway. My name is Jean Lamar. I'm Paiute and Pit River, living in Susanville, California. That's in the northeastern Sierras, close to the border of California. I was always proud of being Indian. I lived with my grandmother through my 7th and 8th grade period, and she told me a lot of stories. Some very touching personal stories. When she was a little girl or when she was growing up, and what they used to do and how they were treated by the early pioneers, and why she was so afraid of the white man, and why she stayed away from the white man. She really had the fear of death because many of her relatives had been killed by the early pioneers for no reason at all, because that was the era. The government wanted early pioneers to kill Indians, $5 a scalp. So our ancestors really had to hide. And I thank them now that because of their skill of hiding that I'm here today, and that I want our generations, future generations, to continue on. Because there's so much to be proud of. I didn't want to show Indians as the victim. I wanted to show the Indians as survivors, as warriors. And we're still here. And we're going to continue to be here. I love to paint. I love to make paper. I love to print. I love to experiment. Art is a one big life of experimentation. And I've tried to tell people, what do you think Windows is about? What is all this video stuff on TV? That's all created by artists. Artists with math on their mind also. People who can create are inventing these things for the future through the computer. It's not done without an artist. An artist is behind it. I feel bad about the Santa Fe artists who have to sell, so I don't have to depend on peddling my work and doing a certain kind of pretty Indian work or a sad Indian huddled in the corner. And, you know, this pitiful, poor Indian, real sympathetic work to grab the hearts of the sorry patron. I don't have to depend on that. I can do what I want. I want creative freedom. This is most important to me, creative freedom. And I can criticize the system. I can criticize history. I can criticize the future. I can criticize my own people as well as non-Indian people without feeling that I have to sell my work. I can show it, I can sell it, or I can keep it. It doesn't matter, as long as I have enjoyed doing it. When I went to Berkeley, I always wanted they should have a white man studies, because then I would learn what is in their mind. And I learned the main thing that the white man strives for is material wealth and gain. And is that what we're here for? Is that what our purpose is? Is that what colonization is about? I'm trying to teach that there's more to life than just material gain.
I've always had this love for photography.
Dugan Aguilar is Walker River Paiute, Pitt River, and Maidu, and has been photographing his people since 1973.
I'm pretty much kind of a self-taught photographer. I was fortunate enough to attend Ansel Adams' workshop at Yosemite, California. And from there, I just took on a whole different, you know, it was a completely different thing for me on photography, and I really started falling in love with the fine art photography. So later in the day after the set was over, I asked, well, could I take a group shot, you know, when the ceremony part was over? And so they said that'd be fine. So that's in my early days where I'd just come from the Yosemite workshop where they were working in large format. So I pulled out this 4x5 camera, and with that, you have to put the hood over your face. And later some people made a remark that I was actually one of the deer dancers that day, because I had this three-legged tripod and two legs of this human with this hood over me, you know? And I said, you're absolutely correct, you know? So I was doing my dancing after they were doing their dancing, I guess. But anyway, I took this one group shot that's kind of, this is one of the major changes on this path that I'm on right now. And I still have it, you know, on my desk at home, and it's of all the Maidu dancers and the singers and the family there. And it's just one of my favorite photographs. This is a day that really changed my life. When I put my camera gear away, I came home the next day and I was unpacking my camera gear. On the bottom of my camera bag was the wormwood ash. And I had left my camera bag in my van, which was 200 yards from where they were dancing, with the windows up. So the next day I came home, and here's this wormwood ash in my camera bag. And I said, well, you know, how is this possible? Photography has always been a good documentary process. Well, first of all, it kind of goes back to, I wanted to be like Edward Curtis. He went out here in this document in the American Indian, and then also part of his thing was it's going to be the Vanishing Breed. But I think mine's to the opposite of that. I just wanted to show that California Indians are alive and well in these days. And so people always want the feathers, in the regalia. That's what they want to see Indians as. But yet today, California Indians are very contemporary, and they're mixed within everybody throughout the state. But I still think it's very important. I think that you have the bridge from your traditional to the very contemporary today. But what I'm trying to show in my photographs is, you know, the California Indians in 1998 that were alive and well, and we've made it through a lot of disease and what, you know, went on in our past. But that's my main purpose. The dance that we were attending was this their deer dance. And so the following week, I was getting ready to travel to the Southwest on vacation, and people told me, get up early to go to the north side of the Grand Canyon because the light's nice and long, and you get those nice, long, black shadows. So we're camping North Rim. So we got up early in the morning before the sun came up, and as we're traveling down the road, one of the first corners that came around here, these four bucks running together, which, you know, it's quite a treat in this day and age because the deer population has been pretty much wiped out. But as we progressed down the highway, another quarter of a mile, half a mile, here were four more bucks. Went down the road another mile or so, four more. So during that morning, we come across about, let's say, between 20 and 30 bucks running together. And then each time, there were always four. And no does, just these four bucks running together. And so later in the day, as the light came up, this one buck was standing out in the high grass there, and so I stopped and took a picture of this buck. And so when I got home back to California, I had taken an image of the deer dance where they had taken the, what we call in California, the flagpole, and what that consisted of was the flicker feathers and acorns and eagle feathers, and then at the top we had our deer horns. So I'd taken an image of that pole, and so I took that and put those together. And I take a lot of pictures, but I think what happens is every now and then one of those pictures will turn into a photograph or, you know, an image.
I'm Susan Billy. I'm from the Hopland Rancheria, Hopland Band of Pomo Indians. The memories that I have that I trace to this part of my life, we did own some of my grandmother's baskets, just a few. And I used to be very fascinated by the baskets and kind of entranced by them, I guess. I would ask my father about them, but he didn't really know too much, or not that he was willing to tell me, I guess. His response generally was that someday when I grew up, I could look at my Aunt Elsie Allen, in Ukiah. I basically knocked on her door and said, you don't know me, but I'm your relative, and I'm here to learn about the basket weaving, or learn about the baskets. I wasn't really sure what I was going to learn. I don't think that growing up I thought I was going to become a basket weaver. I was curious about them, and I was very drawn to the baskets. And I don't really think that I even knew what the questions were yet. But I knew that somehow I was connected. She was very surprised. She said, wow, what are you doing here? None of the young people want to learn this. She was very surprised and very excited, really. She invited me in immediately, and we started to talk. And when I walked into the door, she held out her hand and had an awl and a knife in her hand and gave them to me and told me they had belonged to my grandmother. And she wanted to pass them on to me. When my grandmother had died, the family had given her all the roots and the willows and the tools. So she had used some of them. And she said when I had left the previous evening, she realized that she'd been holding these for me. So that's how I got my tools. They were my grandmother's. And I felt very honored to have them. And that began my work with her. And I spent basically the next 16 years studying with Elsie and learning as much as I could. Now, many of those days, we weren't just sitting and weaving. Some days we were out looking at the plants. Some days we were gathering. Often she would just call me up and say, we need to go visit the sedge, or we need to go check on those willows, or see how the redbud's doing, or, you know, it's such a pretty day, let's just go for a drive. When I arrived on Elsie's doorstep, I really had no expectations. I had no preconceived ideas, really. I knew that was the next step, and I just had to be there. Elsie was always so patient and so methodical and just so gentle in her manner that You know, she never, even if you made a mistake, she never made you feel bad or tell you you did the wrong thing. You know, she never used those kinds of words. She would just say, this is how I do it. And then the learning part of the weaving, I literally sat at her feet because I had a good view looking up at her hands working. And also, she just had this big chair and she had tables on each side of her chair. So it wasn't really possible for me to sit right next to her, which was fine. I began my work in her home and I sat on the floor at her feet watching her, how she would clean the materials and how she did things. And I'd be working and I'd be looking and I'd be working and looking at her. A lot of her teaching method was by example. She didn't say, now watch me. You know, she wasn't that kind of a teacher. She would just do things. And if you were paying attention, you'd notice. She was just so patient. She was so patient. She was kind of my life at that time, you know, for all those years. Whatever she said is what we did. From day to day, it wasn't like I thought, well, I'm going to do this for the next 5 years or for the next 10 years, I'm going to study with Elsie. That wasn't it. It's just each day I woke up and I went and I was with Elsie. And that just went along. Elsie passed away on New Year's Eve 1990. Just prior to that, the newest high school in Santa Rosa was built, and while they were going through the process of taking names for consideration, Elsie's name was selected. They were looking for someone who was a role model and who had devoted their life to working with young people or being interested in young people, teaching, that kind of thing. And it was quite a landmark decision because no school in Sonoma County had ever been named after a woman, as far as I know, and certainly not an Indian woman. So, you know, the family was very surprised, and that was amazing. I'm very thankful that the timing was just so perfect for me in my life that I could spend that time with her. And, you know, I always felt bad that I didn't learn more. I learned a lot from her, but I know that I just touched the surface of what that woman knew. She gave me a tremendous gift. She gave me those last 16 years of her life, and I'm just very grateful for that.
California Contemporary Indian Artists. This program was written and produced by Kathy Chapman and Peggy Berryhill. Production assistants, N'Jamile Carol Jones. Project director, Roby Cook. Digital mixing and editing, Neil Harvey. Series executive producer, Peggy Berryhill. Thanks to Exit, Michael Stearns, Ron Sunsinger, and Alvino Siva, William Eaton, and the other music artists whose work appeared in this program. Thanks also to the singers whose music came from the California Indian Library Collection, and to Leroy Miranda Jr. for Gord Rattle Sounds. The music of Kol Yudimo appears in our opening theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.